Ahead and jump right into the class. Remember the key words, the key idea that keeps repeating itself in chapters 2 and 3 is the phrase, I know, that's said to all seven churches. I know, Jesus says, what you're going through. I know you. I know my people. And that's very comforting for many different ways. Normally what I've done in all the other times I've studied Revelation is to make the application to he knows what sufferings we're going through, because that's one of the main emphasis of the book of Revelation is persecutions. But today, after we're done with the seventh church, I want you to think about all the problems and challenges that these churches were going through. How does that phrase help to comfort them? If they were poor materially, with all those problems and challenges, and I have a list of them, you know, that phrase I know has a larger meaning, I think, when you take it in the context of the problems and challenges that these seven churches were facing. Let's go ahead and get into the text itself. Verse 7. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, and who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, and have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet, and to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world, to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And one of the things I have not done, because it would take probably over a year to do this, is to point out every single Old Testament reference in the book of Revelation. I mean, it is like one verse after another, there's a reference somewhere to the Old Testament. Example, he who has a key of David, he opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. If you go back to Isaiah chapter 22 and verse 22, that passage says, the key of the house of David I will lay on his shoulder, talking about Jesus. And he shall open and no one shall shut. He shall shut and no one shall open. I mean, this verse is almost a direct reference to Isaiah chapter 22 and verse 22. And there, like I said, three quarters, about 75% of the verses have either a direct reference to the Old Testament or an allusion to some passage in the Old Testament. And I don't want to overlook, you know, because I can't center on all of those. That would be a study in and of itself to take a look at all of those. But something like this is an indication that Jesus has all authority. He is the only way to gain heaven. Another emphasis there, especially remember that as we're getting later in the text and we're talking about the difficulties specifically that Jesus is addressing in Revelation chapter 6 through 19. Or actually, it's verse 20, chapter 20. All right, the city's position on the trade routes easily conjures up this idea of a door in order to get into the rest of Asia Minor. You had to get through, you had to go through Philadelphia. One of the major ways that production, things that they produced was agricultural, and it was a big producer of grapes and wines, which was a big produce for this time period. I know your works. See, I've set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength, and have kept my word, and have denied my faith. What is Jesus saying to the church here? What is it he's indicating as one of the challenges that this group of Christians was facing in this verse? What does that indicate to you? What's the challenge? Persecution? And that comes even more clear later. Is there anything else here in this verse that you can see? Yeah, what do you make of that little strength there? He says, you have a little strength. We know he's not talking, and this is my second point on my slide, so I won't bring it up. But we know he's not talking about their faith. Because there's nothing that he condemns them for here. They were a faithful group of people. And we're going to talk about what he has to say. I'm going to keep you from the hour of trial that's going to come upon the whole world, which is an indication that either it's an exemption from the persecutions that they were going to face, the whole world was going to face, which is what I think the book's talking about, or he's saying something else very similar to that. So this little strength does not have reference to them spiritually because they were a powerhouse. Kevin? Possibly. Possibly. I think there's something else. I think this is referencing something else, which is a challenge. I think so. This was a small group of Christians. I think this what's referencing here is that this is a small group of Christians, few in number. Jesus says, I know that you are few in number. Now, how many that was, I don't know. You know, but as I said, that we know that it's not them spiritually, but I think it's referencing the fact that they were not a large group, or they didn't have, as Kevin pointed out, didn't have political strength. But I think it's probably more so the small number. So, in what ways can being few in number be a challenge to Christians? Then, if you're with you think about the congregations. There are a lot of congregations around the world, a lot of congregations in this country. You go up north, and there are several places up north to where they only have services on Sunday because brethren have to drive from such a long distance in order to meet. And there are some congregations even in this state that there may only be 10 or less brethren. And in a lot of places around the world, very few in number. In Russia, the congregations are very small. Very small. So how can that be a challenge then to Christians, to a congregation when it's few in number? Okay. Elijah, yeah. Elijah, when he thought he was alone, he wanted to give up, didn't he? Yeah. Good point. Jacob? All right. Adam?
I grew up in a small church. There were 12 of us, and my family only grew up six. There were six of us, so we could make up half the church. And being a small church, it was very hard when you're teaching the community in the woman, because why would they go to you? How can you be teaching the truth if everybody else, you know, has a bigger family? You know, so that's a big challenge. Everyone thinks you're wrong because you're so small. It's hard to get people in there, you know, even when they do move into the area because they're such a small church. You know, the ages weren't the right ages for people moving in with families, so they didn't want to stay and work with you, you know. And it weighs on your heart. It weighs on your mind consistently because I grew up right next to Dad knocking on doors. We had a booth to prepare, you know, did all that we could, you know, but being few in number, weighs on your heart because you're consistent.
Okay.
Anytime someone moves in, it's very important. And when they move away, it's very important.
Okay. So So the cornerstone members, everybody's a cornerstone member. And when you lose one, it goes back to another challenge that another congregation faced. Anyone else? Yeah, go ahead, Beth. Yeah, it's a challenge. It is a challenge. And that's what I think you see here. Because this congregation, Jesus doesn't say anything negative to them. So this is not a sin, is it? This is not a sin. There's nothing mean that because a number is few in number that something's wrong. Jesus, this is a powerhouse congregation. This is one of only two that Jesus has nothing negative to say to. Nothing negative. All right? So I just came up with a few things. A lot of you have already said it. Being able to do certain works, getting out into the community. So it becomes much more difficult to do, has already been indicated. How about singing? What do you think the singing's like in a small congregation, especially if the small congregation's in a large building? There's a congregation, at least there was, when I worked with the church up in Barberton many years ago when I was in college, went and preached at one of the churches in inner city Cleveland. And it was, at one time I'm told, there was 300 members, but they were down to like 40. And it was a building a bit large enough to hold 300 members. And I remember the singing. And it was, imagine the singing. Huge building, few numbers, and especially if the brethren all spread out. It was not an encouragement to say by looking at it from just the sound. From viewing it from just the sound. All right. So just think about the singing here at a congregation like that. And as already been indicated, elders, deacons, it's hard to have it being a big congregation like the Lord wants a congregation to be. As already indicated, one of the things that people look for is people to your own age to be able to associate with. I just kind of threw this in here. I should have put it at the end. And I'm kind of ahead of myself because we're going to talk about lessons about all this for a moment. Think about the teenage Christian who's in a high school and there's no other Christian in the high school with them. There are ways that this becomes applicable even in a large congregation, if you have young Christians that are by themselves at a large high school. Encouragement, edification, all of that that's already been indicated. So what lessons can we get from this? Kevin? His hand was really high in case you didn't see, so he's ready for this one. And you turned out okay. As well, let me just say that in the first one. You turned out okay.
But I moved from that.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of my point, is that I moved from that, and I don't know where I grew up for a reason. I went to high school with two other Christians, one of which is at the sister of Winslow, and our Christian environment is small in this world. But my point, I guess, to make is, how often do we do some of the things, make our own challenges? What I mean by that is, you might go
To make it small and to make it, yeah,
I
understand. There was a purpose for the new work.
There was a
scriptural, a spiritual reason,
yes,
to start the new work.
In that case, yes, and I'm aware of that, but other people, I just wonder how much do we hurt ourselves as Christians in that way.
Okay.
And the second note, and I'll just call it off today, I
promise. We'll see.
How much do we control what we do? What I mean by that is we take our job, you know, somewhere else, or we do a different job. And I say that as a soldier, but I've been able to be assigned places that had churches.
Mm-hmm.
I've been lucky enough to do that. And, you know, some aren't. So there are places where, you know, that kind of thing. And my units have been and had a lot of Christians, or several Christians, at least, to help us to worship with. But how often do we pick up our family and go, you know, we need to live somewhere else for the good of our family? And it goes back
spiritually. Balance and harmony.
And it's a very interesting time, and each family has to do that on its own.
Carrie, and then Mark, and then Ricky. Okay, Mark first, and then Carrie, then Ricky.
You know, as important as those things are, every one of them is extremely important. I still go back to the end of the verse where it says, and have kept my word and have not denied my name. You know, I too have been a member of church, and I might be the only man there that day that was doing the leading prayer.
And I'm going to talk more about what you're saying in just a second. Remember what he said. Carrie?
There are personalities in churches, cliques, new forms at times, you know, that's just human nature. People flock to people, you know, if they like or they have something in common with it. So not a lot of good comes out of splits. I mean, you may start to work somewhere else. You may bring a few people in, but I see more harm than good caused by it. And I think if you wanted to bring these guys together, you know, we're talking about, it takes leadership of the local congregation to get it together. And hey, what's best for us, overall best for the Lord's church? How can we best serve the community here? And can we rearrange some things with what you just said, combine a few efforts,
okay,
or spread out more? I just don't think they do a good job of these church talking to church leadership. And some churches don't have elders. I mean, a lot of churches are under, so they don't have elders. But they're still leaders in the church. They may not be elders, but they're still people in the church.
Have a voice. Yep.
I don't think we do a good job. I think we go to these four walls every week, and we don't know what the church over in Brandon is doing. We don't know what the church over in wherever it's at. You know, that's where it's going.
Okay. Rick, and then I'm going to make some comments because I do want to get done with chapter 3 today. And really, I think as a segue into what I want to mention here with this, and just point out to get everybody thinking about with this, is that I really think what's said in Philadelphia, and that's why I started off by referencing Isaiah 22, is that the focal point, and this needs to be the case whether you're in a large congregation or a small congregation, doesn't matter the numbers. The focal point of your service to Christ is what? It's Christ. So it doesn't matter how many you worship with. Because it doesn't matter. If your focal point is not Christ, it doesn't matter if you're worshiping with a huge number of Christians. You're wrong. If your focal point is not Christ, then you've got a problem. The focal point of the Church of Philadelphia was Jesus Christ. I'll give you an example of what I mean there. Singing. If we leave after singing praises to God and not feel uplifted, where was our focal point? What was our focus? Ourselves. Because it doesn't matter if there's one other person singing with you or 1,000 people singing with you. If you're singing praises to Christ and your focal point is Christ, then you should feel uplifted. You understand what I'm saying? And when brethren come in, it really bothers me when I hear brethren saying, well, I'm attending over here because there's just people my own age that I have things I'm able to do things with. What's the focal point? What is the purpose of attending that congregation? Is it to worship Christ? Is it to serve Christ? Who's at the focus? Myself. And we all know brethren that have said that. Folks, when we make that kind of statement, we are the focus. And Jesus Christ is not the focus. So it really should not matter the number that we're serving with. If our focus is Jesus Christ, if He is the focus, we are going to be edified. We're going to be encouraged, regardless of the numbers. Regardless of the numbers. And that's the point of Isaiah 22. He has the key. He is the one that should be our focus because He is in charge. You know, so consequently, yes, these are challenges. Because a lot of times our focus is not on Christ as it needs to be. It's on ourselves. A lot of hands are going up, even Kevin's. But Todd first, then Kevin. Goes back to that harmony. It's hard. And that's challenging when you try to harmonize decisions by taking into account everything. Oh, I know. And that's the challenge. You're right, because that is the challenge. How do all these other principles come into play with that decision? And balancing it, not balancing your decision on one particular area, because you can't do that. You can't weight more one area stronger unless there's a scriptural reason. You got to balance it and harmonize it. And that's why those decisions become so much harder as we grow more knowledgeable in the Word of God, because we have to start taking more things in. That's an excellent, excellent point. Kevin, then Jacob. I would say my point is that when we start making decisions on what's best for me as an individual and not what's best for Christ, our focal point is not what it needs to be. And that goes back to what Todd was saying. Because you got to take into account maybe your family. But to weight your family greater than what you can do for others, you know, if you can be a big influence for this congregation over here, more so than this congregation over here, but you're weighting your family over what's best for others, I think Jesus in Matthew 22 says, who is it that needs to be at the focus? Well, God first, and then who else? Then who? Others. That selfless attitude. And that's why those decisions become harder, as Todd was just pointing out. So your focal point needs to be on what's best for Christ, not necessarily what's best for me as an individual. Jacob? and more. And there's even, I'll even look at it in terms of more pressure to accomplish more, because I do know of a parable that says that the more talents you have, the more what's expected. More responsibility, the more Jesus expects from you. And if you're not fulfilling using those talents, then you got a problem. Rebecca, did you have a comment? Called growth. Yeah, that's exactly right. There's so much in the scriptures about learning from older individuals. But not only that respect, I just also point out, you know, when you have children and you're in a small number, what should happen to you as a family unit if you're relying on each other even more so? What happens to you as a family unit then? You become stronger and closer. And so you have the benefits. Yes, there are negatives, but there are challenges. I'm not saying negatives. Challenges, I like the word better. As opposed to, there are challenges, but there are also so many benefits. Mark, and then we got to go on.
I was thinking of Noah.
Few in number. Noah. Whole world. Yeah, it's a challenge. And don't think it's not a challenge, because Jesus says, I know, I'm here to let you know that this is something you are going to be rewarded for, because this is a faithful congregation. All right, I do want to get on, because as much as I like Philadelphia, I think I only got 15 minutes. We're not going to get on with chapter 3, because we're going to be discussing Philadelphia. I mean, we're going to be discussing Laodicea for a while. Let me finish off Philadelphia here. Verse 9, because you have kept the word of my patience, I will also keep you from the hour of trial, which has come upon the whole world, to test those that dwell on the earth. You know, there's been a lot of discussion in verse 9, and I don't have the answer for it. Is Jesus saying he's going to keep them, exempt them from the what's going to happen through the rest of the book of Revelation, or is he not going to exempt them? Homer Haley says this is probably not in reference to an abstaining from a physical persecution or death. From what is said in the rest of the book of Revelation, Christ is not talking about exemption, but preservation. And, you know, I just tell you, every time I study the book of Revelation and teach it, I go from one to the other. Yes, it's exemption, no. And then I say, no, it's not exemption. And yes, it's exemption, and no. It's tough. I'm not real sure what he is promising this congregation here in terms of whether they're going to be preserved or exempted from the upcoming challenges that the rest of the book talks about. So we add to the challenges. Really, there's no problems with this church. We add to the challenges. Another congregation facing persecution. That's three now congregations that were facing the challenge of persecution. And then, and I'm also going to include here one of the challenges, being a small congregation. Being a small congregation. That is a challenge. Let's get into Laodicea. And to the angel of the church of Laodiceans write, these things says the Amen, the faithful and the true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, that you are neither cold or hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. Because you say, I am rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing, and do not know what you are wretched, that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in fire, that you may be rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with the eye salve, that you may see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore, be zealous and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him and he with me. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And boy, you could spend weeks on this church. The city itself was very, very rich. There was a huge earthquake in 60 AD that basically decimated the entire city. The Romans came to the city and said, we'll give you like, you know, billions of dollars to help rebuild your city. And the elders of the city said, not the elders of the church, but the elders of the city said, nope, we don't need your money. We can do it on our own. And they did. A lot of arrogance involved with this city as a whole. And as we've already indicated, a lot of times that which is taking place in the world seeps into where? To the church. Maybe not to the same degree, but it is still there. And so, you know, you need to understand what's going on in this city because you start to see a lot of it in the attitude that Jesus discusses with the congregation here. This city was a huge banking community. Let's start with looking at what he says to them. Nothing positive, by the way. I know your works, that you are neither hot nor cold. I could wish that you were hot or cold. What's Jesus saying to them there here? What does it mean to be lukewarm? Okay. There's nothing there for it. Yes. You know, even their works were not what he wanted. And we'll talk about that in a second. So when a person is lukewarm, what are some characteristics of a person that is complacent, spiritually lethargic, that's lukewarm? Can you think of any characteristics of somebody like that? No emotion. Okay. No heart with it. All right. What else? Roots are not deep enough. All right. Okay, not dedicated. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yep. And that was a big problem here. It's like having a period of peace after war. How do people become when you fight, when you have a war for a long period of time? What happens to that nation after the war? What's the attitude of the nation? Well, if you win. Yeah, if you won. It's a relaxed attitude, is it not? A lot of what you just said references that. Allowing other people to do your work for you. That self-importance that Jacob was talking about. And this one, I like, because I think our country has become a lukewarm country. And the major characteristic, I think, of a lukewarm people is a feeling of entitlement. I what? I deserve this. I deserve this. And while we may never say that, our actions may indicate that. I deserve to not have to do that. I really don't want to do that, go out and help knock on doors. I really don't want to. I've been doing it all my life. I just want to have some rest for a while. That's a feeling of entitlement, folks. That's an entitled attitude. And you know what Jesus says to us? After we've done everything we're supposed to do, we are still unprofitable servants. We are not an entitled people. That's this congregation of Laodicea. That's the congregation. They were an entitled congregation. The city was an entitled city. They felt like they were entitled. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Colossians 4:1, I think it is, talks about the layout. Paul talks about the Laodiceans, and it was not in a negative way. It's just a layout, the congregation of Laodicea. And taking this even one step further there with this feeling of entitlement, couple that feeling of entitlement together with a desire for comfort. I have worldly up on the board, being concerned with worldly. But what I see with this country, because we are a lukewarm country, is not only a feeling of entitlement, but a desire for comfort. Couple that together, and we just deserve things, do we not? I mean, is that not the attitude of the Americans? We deserve things. Even if we can't afford it, we deserve it, right? So what are we going to do? We're going to go into debt obtaining these things. They're not a need, they're a want. And we deserve those things. And in a spiritual sense, need to be careful that we do not have that feeling of entitlement and that we don't start being concerned with comfort in our lives in a spiritual way. That's a tough one. This is even more tougher. We're not going to finish with it, but I'm going to start the conversation so you all can think about it all week. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in fire, that you may be rich in white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. I want you to be thinking about this verse. We've got about 4 minutes, so I'm going to present an idea. And we'll probably start the discussion, but I want you to think about this verse, because this is what Jesus tells them. How do you correct this problem in Laodicea? Jesus says this is how you correct it. A lot of you were shaking your head yes when I was talking about this country and this being the problem in this country. So if this is a problem within this country, I would submit to you that to a degree it's probably also a problem with what in this country? The churches. As we already said, you see a lot of the attitude within a country seeping into the church. This is a tough, tough, tough verse, challenging verse. Not so much in what it means, but how you apply it. It says, should we be praying for persecutions? That's what he says. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in fire. Put that together with what Peter says. How is gold refined in fire? What is it that refines gold? It's persecutions. That's what he tells us. When was the last time you prayed for that? If this is a problem, I believe it is. Should we be praying for that? Well, I don't know if he prayed for it. He was more talking about the difficulties going through. Now, here's the reason why we don't pray for persecutions, which takes me back to my last slide. Because persecutions would indicate that we're going to lose what? Our comfort. Our privilege. Our entitlements. Persecutions would imply that we lose all of those. So should we? Is that not what, as Christians, we are the salt, as Jacob pointed out, we are the salt of the earth. Now, we're the salt, yes, of the earth, but we're also the salt of our country. Should we be doing what's best spiritually for our country? Should we? That's a lesson. So should we be praying for our country to go through persecutions, to be humbled? And should this be a major prayer? Because as long as a country doesn't think they need God, Will they ever look to God? Will they ever try to find God? So as Christians, should we not be praying for that? But in praying for that, it would mean we would be losing our comforts. It would mean we'd be losing what things we have. Because we all know, all you have to do is go back. I was watching the History Channel. I love the History Channel. My kids don't like me to have the television clicker because I turn to the History Channel whenever I have that television clicker. I can watch that. But there was on Saturday morning, there was a 2-hour special on the Depression in this country. Isn't it interesting that when did the Lord's church grow and prosper in this country? Yeah. Think about where the Lord's church grows and prospers. But then you look at the Depression and what the people went through. Was it pleasant? Would we want our children to have to go through that? Would we want our grandchildren to have to experience that kind of thing? So what is our focus? Let's go back to what we were just talking about so long ago. Not so long ago, with the balance and harmony and doing what's best for our families, what's best for our children, over what's best for everything else, everyone else. That's not the attitude, Matthew 22. Attitude needs to be with what's best for Christ, what's best to save souls. What does it matter if we live like Lazarus, if we have the same end as the rich man? We don't want the end as the rich man. So if that means I got to live like Lazarus so I can have the same end as Lazarus, so be it. If that means my children have to live like Lazarus so they can have the same end as Lazarus, so be it. I don't want to live like the rich man and have his same end. Do you see the danger here? So I ask this question. And that's how we're going to begin because the bell's about to ring. A lot of hands went up. I'll call on you next week. Think about this week. Is this something we need to be praying for and should be praying for? And if we don't pray for it, why are we not praying for it? Leave that with you. We'll discuss it next week. Maybe we'll get done with chapter 3 next week.